We're in your long list.
Other ones, Snell was a student too, contemporary. And Snell was absolutely first rate.
And he came on the staff then?
Yeah, his was on the staff for a good many years. His wife was from Texas. She never liked was Madison very well. They went back to Texas for a while, and then from Texas he went to Berkeley, and he was on the Berkeley staff until his early 60s, and then Berkeley had a compulsory retirement at 65 at that time. So Es moved back to University of Texas at Austin and was to be chairman of microbiology, and he still has that position. But Es was the authority on vitamin B6 in all the metabolic reactions that are catalyzed by this. And so this was sort of his career. And he was a very versatile person and a first-rate scientist.
Do you remember when nicotinic acid was, when that was discovered?
It was, I would think it was 37.
I mean, do you remember the event of it?
Oh, sure.
How does the word seep around among the graduate students?
Well, I took the plant biochemistry laboratory from Tottingham in the spring, I think, of 37. And we did it in an old room, I guess it was room 25 downstairs. It was an old laboratory. And working in the teaching lab was Madden. Mm-hmm. And Madden was trying to isolate nicotinic acid. So while we were doing our lab work down there, we'd chat with Madden, and so we knew what was going on. Through much of it, he was pouring the active fraction down the sink, it turned out eventually, but he finally chased it down anyway. And so he was doing the isolations. We were curious about it, how things were going. And I don't know whether it was that fall or just when it was. It might have been the fall of 37 or something. Word came around. E.B. Fred had said that Connie had isolated the antipolate refractor. And there was some confusion about the nomenclature, I remember. Somebody came up and said that Connie had isolated such and such a vitamin. But we said, that one's been isolated. And there was a little confusion about the nomenclature. If they just said nicotinic acid, why then it'd be clear. But they call it B1 or B2 or something. And so the B vitamin thing was a bit confused. And so somebody said, well, that one's been isolated. He said, no, that's not right. So the rumor came around that it was isolated, characterized, and that was it. So I was a student at that time, so we heard about it, I think, rather shortly. And it just came by word of mouth up to the department.
But you must have heard about the Link's lab was used and Campbell did the
characterization. Yeah, well, that's not surprising because, of course, everybody that had a carbon hydrogen microanalysis to do took it up to Link's laboratory because they were equipped for microanalysis and nobody else was equipped.
And they felt that they ought to have gotten more credit for it.
I don't know whether they should have gotten any more credit. After all, you can take these things off and send it to a commercial lab and it comes back with a CHN analysis. Mm. Mm. So this is always a question. I mean, this is a routine operation. It's like somebody come up and say how much nitrogen is in this sample, and I ran a Kjeldahl analysis and told them that it was 2 4/10% nitrogen. Mm. I wouldn't expect any credit from this sort of thing. That was a routine application. And commercial laboratories would do this.
Van Potter said the question was, do you come to somebody and say, what is this? Or do you come to them and say, is this? And that it makes a big difference. That is, if
Van was much closer to it than I was. He was working in the next laboratory. You see, KP's laboratory was in the far corner, and Van worked with Connie in the adjacent laboratory. Mm. He was right next to KP's laboratory. So undoubtedly, he was in touch with him. I was up in Ag Hall, behind Ag Hall, so I was in a different building, so I wasn't nearly as close to it, and I was not really privy to any exchange between them or any difficulty about this. I don't think Campy was particularly disturbed about it, was he?
He is now.
Is he?
Mm.
Oh, well, these things, you'd think that they'd wash out in 40 or 50 years, but people forget these things rather slowly, I'm afraid. No, I don't know. I mean, it's, if Campy told him this is nicotinic acid, that's one thing. If he told him what the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen analysis was and said, you put it together, if he actually identified it as nicotinic acid, I'd see he might have some questions.
I think that's what he thinks.
Maybe he did. I really don't know. I never heard that. So I didn't know that there was any hard feeling. So it apparently was not something that surfaced at that time very seriously.
Fred had to, E.B. Fred finally put his foot down and said, I mean, Link wanted some kind of credit in the list of the people who discovered it. Well, so it is nicotinic acid, not niacin.
Well, niacin or nicotinic acid, I mean, it's just different derivatives.
Same structural
formula, but you can have it in various forms. The body will convert it. The body will convert it to an active form, so it really isn't that.
But if I'm indexing it, I say nicotinic acid, the discovery of it. I don't.
Or you can, you can use niacin. It's perfectly okay. Niacin.
I've been puzzled by that. Well.
But, you know, I could say something about the penicillin. You see, penicillin was discovered quite some time before it was actually utilized. But in World War II, with the difficulty with healing of wounds and all this sort of thing, and all kinds of infections, war-related, there was a revival of interest in penicillin, and a group at Oxford in England got out the old Fleming strains of penicillia and started to work, see if they couldn't improve the yield and make some actual tests. Tests had been very minimal up to that time. So they got the penicillium strains out and grew them and concentrated the active factor from the broth and found that in certain patients they got spectacular responses. Some of the staphylococcal infections and such, spectacular responses. And they started to do some studies on it. They developed an assay which was known as the Oxford assay, in which they would put their active ingredient in a small cup which was placed directly on, it was an open-ended cup which was formed by putting the little glass tube on a piece of auger, and then you'd put the material in and diffuse on the auger, and it would inhibit the growth of bacteria which were seeded over the whole plate. On the basis of the diameter, you judge the number of so-called Oxford units. So there were some studies on this, and the responses were spectacular. So the suggestion was that people in the U.S. join with the group at Oxford and try to scale this up so that they could make additional tests and perhaps use it in war-related diseases and such.
Excuse me, were you involved in this yourself?
Yeah, I
were. You were,
I have, okay. I have about three papers on penicillin.
Oh.
My impact was not that great, but I was involved in
uh-huh.
it. So the people in this country started to work on it, and one of the people that obviously got in early, or two people, were Charles Thom, T-H-O-M, and Ken Raper. They had worked together, and they had published a volume on the penicillia, which is the definitive volume on the area. So they were the experts on the penicillia, which produce penicillin. And Ken Raper, the British came over with information about what they had on it, and Ken Raper moved out to the Northern Regional Laboratory in Peoria, Illinois, and took strains of penicillin, and they started working on it there. But one thing that was a problem was to increase the yields, because the yields were small, and even after they'd gotten it onto the laboratory stage, so there's enough to test. It cost about $20, 100,000 Oxford units. So it was quite costly. Incidentally, before the end of the war, it was down to 3 cents, 100,000 units. So the developments changed the price from $20 to 3 cents, 100,000 units. And then it went lower than that subsequently. But I remember it was about 3 cents at the end of the war. Well, the the job was to find a very active strain that would produce a lot and to find a good medium on which to grow the organism. And the other big problem was to find some way to grow it in submerged culture. Up to this point, it had all been grown on what's known as surface culture. That is, they'd seed a liquid medium with the spores, and the penicillia would grow over the surface, and it would elaborate the penicillin into the medium, and then you would just isolate it from the medium. This involves a fantastic amount of handling, the individual bottles. The companies tooled up for this, and they'd handle hundreds of thousands of bottles. And so if you could grow in a 10,000 gallon fermenter or something like that, you would greatly minimize the work. So there was this, they sought a submerged strain. The original strains did not work well in submerged culture. Now there were a number of active groups. The Northern Regional Laboratory came out with an improved medium. This was a so-called corn steep liquor medium. Instead of using expensive meat extracts and such, they used the residue from extraction of starch from corn, so-called corn steep liquor, which you could buy for a few cents a pound. It was a byproduct. Mm-hmm. And yet it had the nutrients in there which would support the growth of the organism. So the medium was largely solved by the Northern Regional Lab with their corn steep liquor medium. Then there was this search for better strains of the organism that would produce more penicillin. And there was a collaborative effort there. There was a fellow on the East Coast named Demerick who was doing X-ray radiation of strains, and Stauffer and Backus over in the botany department were doing ultraviolet mutations of the strains. And they were being tested. Some of them were tested up at Minnesota, and many of them were tested here by Peterson and Johnson and people up in Bacti. People in Bacti, botany, biochemistry were all involved in this operation here on campus. Well, the one of the better strains which came out was isolated at the Northern Regional Lab. I can't remember the NRRL 1924 B25 or something like that. I may have the number wrong, but anyway, this was isolated from a moldy muskmelon, and was picked up at the Northern Regional Lab, and it turned out to be much more active in production of penicillin. This gives rise to the story about Moldy Mary, who allegedly picked this up. This is apocryphal, actually. Uh-huh. Moldy Mary didn't pick it up in the market. It was brought into the laboratory by somebody who had a moldy melon at home. But anyway, there was a recent celebration down at Peoria about this, and the press converged on Moldy Mary. So all the stories were about Moldy Mary, although yeah, she really was not. The story is really, as I say, apocryphal. Well, in any case, they got this strain, and then it was mutated again with X-rays, and then it was selected, and the strain was sent down here, and Johnson and Peterson, their group, found that this would produce in submerged fermentation if you handled the medium properly. Dave Perlman, who I mentioned, was dean of the pharmacy school here. Dave was working down here in Johnson's lab, and Henry Cuffler was a new recruit up in Bacti, and Henry and I and Dave Perlman worked together trying to figure out the fermentative changes, to see at what stage in the fermentation there was an alteration and penicillin was elaborated. It turned out that in submerged culture that you didn't get any penicillin at first. Then there was a stage at which penicillin was elaborated, and then it disappeared, so you had to get it at the right stage. And it was dependent upon the sugar you used. For a long time, they used lactose as the sugar. Eventually, they found they could use other sugars if they controlled the fermentation properly. So we were following this aspect, the metabolism, the elaboration of the penicillin, and what changes you could make in the fermentation conditions to increase the yield. Well, this mutant that came through and then was mutated with UV over in Bacti turned out that you could operate in submerged culture and you could produce substantial amounts, and this strain was distributed from here. Then, as I said, it was a collaborative effort. It was sent all the penicillin producers in the country, every pharmaceutical company got it, and when they got this one breakthrough, it doubled the production in a month. Yeah. It just doubled it, and so it got to a stage where penicillin price dropped. You could do it by submerged fermentation, you could do it on cheap media. and the extraction processes were done by that time, so you could reasonably clean material at a low price, and it just was a real boon in the treatment of a variety of diseases and infections. So this was a story. A lot of people were involved in it, but sort of the center of the operation was Peterson and Johnson's laboratory here in Biochem. But Bakke contributed biochemistry, or botany contributed, and there were other ones on campus. And I was just checking, and I'd forgotten that I was on a paper with Kuffler and Dave Perlman. I'd forgotten that I was on that one with Perlman, and was on one with Bill Fraser, who was chairman in Bakke for a time. Mm-hmm. So everybody was in on the business.
Was there a moment at which somebody said, this is what we're after?
Well, there had been a gradual increase in yields and a development of submerged fermentation and a knowledge about the method of fermentation, and there was a monthly newsletter went among all of these pharmaceutical companies. So everybody was keeping abreast of it, and I remember going to New York with Pete and Johnson on a trip, and we visited Pfizer and some of the outfits like that, and everybody was sharing information. And so as it developed, it was very quickly put into practice, and there was a gradual increase, and then there was this one mutant that within a month it had doubled the production. So instead of getting a one or two Oxford units per milliliter, not too long they were getting 800 units per milliliter. So it had gone up not tenfold, but around 1,000-fold in the productivity.
So Wisconsin really did play an important
role. It played a very important role in it, yes. But it was a collaborative operation from northern regional and pharmaceutical firms. A lot of people ran on it. Demerick at Cold Spring Harbor, I guess he was, in Minnesota. A lot of people were in on the thing, so it's hard to pinpoint. And at the same time, there was a lot of effort to synthesize the penicillin, which never turned out to be competitive, but Davinio's group at Cornell Medical School in New York eventually synthesized the penicillin. There was a big effort on that, too, but it never could compete with the... Although subsequently they put in precursors, that was another development. If you put in a certain precursor, then the fermentation would carry it on to a type of penicillin you wanted. There were a variety of penicillins that turned out. Originally it was penicillin G and F, and then there are a whole family of penicillins. And you can modify it by putting in precursors groups that are then incorporated by the organism into the penicillin. So this was an interesting development. But the guy who has really studied the history of it and knows it back and forth is Ken Raper up in Bakke. Mm-hmm. He's very well acquainted, although his connection with it was at the Northern Regional Lab, and he came to Wisconsin in 1953, mm-hmm. so it was after this period. But from this was start of a very active era in fermentation. A lot of students went into this, and a lot of them went out into the industry. For the next decade or so, they just went into every industrial pharmaceutical firm in the country. It's then Henry Kuffler who worked on it. I was a postdoc in Perry Wilson's lab at that time, and Henry came. He was born in Vienna, and then he came to this country, took his degree at Arizona, and then came to work with Perry Wilson here. And Perry had gone off to New York for the year. He was working on biological warfare. That was another aspect at that time. A number of people had left for biological warfare work. Al Baldwin ran the Camp Dietrich Laboratory. Mm-hmm. Perry was in New York City at the New York City Health Laboratory. So I sort of kept Perry's show going up there at that time. And so Henry Kuffler and I worked pretty closely. He was a new grad student. I was actually directing his research. Henry is now president of the University of Arizona for about the last year. Mm. He was vice president of Minnesota and then president of Amherst, University of Massachusetts Amherst, and now he is president of Arizona. So he's had quite a distinguished career in microbiology and administration. He first went to Purdue and built a very outstanding biology group there and then moved on to Minnesota.
Was he a refugee?
Yeah, his they were Jewish, and his father was an attorney, actually, a rather prominent attorney, a rather wealthy family in Vienna. They got out with practically nothing. Henry and his mother got out through Italy, and then subsequently his father got out, and Henry and his mother went to Arizona, and Henry was an undergraduate at Arizona, where he's now the president.
Yeah.
And then his father got out later through some other route. And it was sort of a sad case. He'd been a prominent attorney there, but law in Vienna is quite different from law in Wisconsin. And so he never had an opportunity to practice after that. And Henry's mother worked at Rayovac making batteries here. And his father worked in the packaging department down at at Barron's store down in the square. So they made ends meet that way. But they were not bitter about it, you know. They were really a very well-adjusted family. And Henry was a very talented fellow, and he got along well. His father died quite some years ago, but I believe his mother is still living. You know, it was quite a prominent family in Vienna, so it was quite a change to come over here.
You stayed here during the war.
Yeah, I was at Columbia 40 and 41, and then I was back here all the time, and I was never drafted. I was teaching during that period. There was a deficiency of staff. You see, Perry had gone off to New York, and I.L. Baldwin was down at Dietrich, and Bill Sarles had gone over. He was sort of he had gone into the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He was a liaison man between Britain and the U.S. on the bacteriological warfare project.
Yeah.
From very early, he got into it very early, before the rest of the people did. And so I taught bacteriology laboratories during that period. He sort of served as an assistant in teaching up there. So I was fairly involved in the teaching program and in the penicillin and that sort of thing. So I never was drafted for service.
You mean you had an exemption because of?
Yeah, teaching. Mm-hmm. Teaching exemption. Actually, at Columbia, my draft board was over in Harlem.
Mm.
And so I had to go over there and appear. But I got an exemption there for research at Columbia. Then coming back here, I had a teaching exemption during the war. There was one of the people were off, quite a number of them were off on bacteriological warfare. And the people down at Camp Dietrich had to have something to test whether you could disperse bacteria in bacteriological warfare. There was no information on this.
Yeah.
And so what they wanted to do was disperse some organism which would be persistent. Some of the organisms, the disease-causing organisms, of course, are a little bit touchy and easy to destroy. So they wanted something to test. And so they wanted a spore former. And a spore former that was not very common, but one they could pick up on plates. And so they asked Wayne Umbright and myself whether we could grow them a few pounds of spores. Well, nobody had ever grown spores on a pound basis. You know, there are a number of spore-forming bacteria, and you leave the things around and they form spores, but there really hadn't been a lot of information on what triggers this spore formation. In a lecture, they'd say, well, the medium gets deficient in certain nutrients and then spores form.
Yeah.
And that was about it. So Wayne Umbright and I decided we would grow the spores as requested for the tests. And so we grew two types. One of them was Bacillus niger. All the bacilli are spore formers, I guess. We grew Bacillus niger, which forms a black pigment, and we grew Bacillus globigii, which forms a bright orange pigment. And they're not particularly common organisms. They figured, well, you can stick these in a bomb and you can explode it and have petri dishes all around, and you can expose them and then you can let them grow, and where you get an orange spot with Globigii or a black one with Niger, then you know that the spores have been dispersed to that spot. So we grew Globigii and Niger in quantities, found out how you grew spores, And there was an old yeast fermentation plant up in the head house of the greenhouse up at Bankty. And so we cranked that up and spent our Christmas holidays here instead of going home, and grew the first batches of spores for Camp Dietrich. And that's as close as I got to biological warfare. But we did find out how to grow spores and produce them for them. So I would say I'm perhaps prouder of having worked on penicillin than on biological warfare. But during the war, one was mobilized to do what one could for, regardless of the implications.
What happened that you got hired in biochemistry?
Biochemistry? Well, you know, Van Potter has had a rather strong influence on my career. I told you that I came down here as a grad student or to help up in Bankty because Van had suggested to it. And Van was, of course, a student of Connie Elvium's and was one of Connie's better students, and they kept in communication. And there was a possibility of an opening in biochemistry, and Van suggested my name to Connie. And so I came down and interviewed Connie. Things were done on a little more relaxed basis than they are now in terms of recruiting. Now it's very formalized and all that sort of thing. But I came down and talked to Connie, and he quizzed me about things. I'd known him for quite some time. I'd been a student in his courses and that sort of thing. So I don't know what kind of staff action there used to be in those days, but anyway, they said they thought they could use me down here. And I was involved, you see, at that time I was involved in bacteriology and teaching up there and sort of helping keep Perry's laboratory together while he was away. So I was a little ambivalent whether I should pull stakes because I did have some obligations up there. But E.B. Hart was the chairman down here. And sometime in the spring quarter, when Tottingham was teaching plant biochemistry, Todd had a heart attack and died overnight. And so I came down and finished off his course. One of the fellows from KP Lynx gave a couple of lectures on carbohydrates, too. I can't remember his name now, he's in Iowa. But anyway, I finished off the course, and E.B. Hart said, well, do you want to come down or don't you want to come down? July 1. And so I'd been very close to Perry Wilson. We always got along fine. But, you know, I sort of had the feeling that if I were to stay in Bankty, which I had an opportunity to stay in Bankty too, that I'd just be the younger accessory for Perry, and that if I came to biochem, I'd have a much better chance for independence. And so I came down here, no hard feelings with Perry or anything like that, but you know, you're always the kid. Like Marv Johnson, in a sense, was that way with Pete. He grew up with Pete, and it was Pete and Johnson. And Johnson didn't resent it at all, but he was always sort of under Pete's shadow, in a sense. And so I decided to come down. I had finished off Todd's course, and then I came down July 1 and settled down in room 150, which was Tottingham's old laboratory, which was in the 39 wing. You see, it was relatively new at that time. So I came down on July 1, 1944, and stayed from then. So this is actually what triggered it immediately was Tottingham's death. And it had been in the works before that time, possibility of a staff appointment.
Was it thought of as a better department?
Bankty was a very distinguished department at that time, as was biochemistry. And I think either department was, they both had very high stature at that time. I would say that Bankty and biochem were much closer in stature at that time than they are now.
Biochem has moved ahead.
Yeah, Bankty has slipped and biochem has moved ahead, I would say. And I'm not saying that from a prejudice standpoint. I think that's an objective statement, that Bankty has slipped somewhat and biochem has really stayed right in there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're both very distinguished departments.
Bacteriology sounds rather old-fashioned these days.
Instead of microbiology? You mean instead of microbiology or what?
Well, perhaps. I mean, is that the reason that it's a...
I don't know. I wouldn't want to attribute anything to it.
You understand, I'm a complete outsider in this.
No, I mean, both the fields have burgeoned in recent years. Biochem, since World War II, has really exploded. But also Bacti, because you see the stuff in genetics, all the developments in genetics, much of it has stemmed from microbiological studies. Mm. So microbiology departments have also gone up enormously in recent years. So it isn't that biochem nationwide has forged ahead of Bacti. Both areas have expanded very rapidly, and both have had very challenging areas to exploit. But it's just on the local scene. I don't know whether it's leadership or what it is, but I don't think that the Bacti has kept up as well. Others would share that, although not necessarily everybody, but I think that definitely Biochem has a better staff now than Bacti. He was at Columbia at that time.
Mm.
So are you on the...
Yeah.
Well, after completing my bachelor's degree, I received a National Research Council fellowship. These were administered by the National Research Council, which, of course, is the working arm of the National Academy of Sciences. And there have been a number of people here who'd received NRC fellowships in the past, such as Elizabeth McCoy. Elizabeth was quite astounded that I got a fellowship because she didn't think I was smart enough for one. But anyway, I got one despite Elizabeth. And so I had written up a project to study biological nitrogen fixation using the stable isotope N15 as a tracer. I talked about this to Wayne Umbright quite a bit. Wayne and I worked together in Perry's laboratory, and Wayne for some years was on the staff in Biochem after he completed his degree and had done some postdoc work with Waxman at Rutgers. But anyway, it sounded like a good project because there had been no tracer available for studying nitrogen fixation before. The radioactive isotope of nitrogen 13 has a half-life of 10.5 minutes, so you have to work pretty rapidly to operate with that. On the other hand, the stable isotope, of course, which is completely stable, is the rare isotope N15. And at that time, the only person in the world who had any N15 available was Harold Urey at Columbia. Urey had made his Nobel Prize discoveries in discovering heavy hydrogen. And then he had gone on from this to try to concentrate other stable isotopes. And by 1940, he had concentrated sulfur 34, nitrogen 15, carbon 13, and the rare isotope of lithium, and probably a couple of other ones such as that. Now, the stable isotopes could serve as tracers. You could put them in at more than the normal abundance, and you could trace their fate through an organism, microorganism, animal, or plant, and get some idea of the metabolism that was going on. This had been particularly exploited with N15 by Rudolf Schoenheimer at College of Physicians and Surgeons, which, of course, is the med school associated with Columbia University. Dave Rittenberg had taken his PhD with Urey, and then he had taken the techniques up and joined Schoenheimer at PNS, and they had studied what was known as the dynamic state of protein in the animal body. And they had found with N15 as a tracer that the protein was much more dynamic and turned over in the animal body, much more than had been anticipated. So it was really a revolutionary group of studies by Schoenheimer and Rittenberg. And so this suggested the idea that you could use the same kind of tracer on biological nitrogen fixation. So this is what I wrote up for the NRC fellowship, and they approved it. And so I went to Urey's laboratory. He was located in the chemistry department at Columbia University.
But I also had a laboratory over in Botany there with Sam Trelease, and this gave a place where I could grow plants if I wanted to and that sort of thing. And later in the spring, I did work up with Schoenheimer and Rittenberg up at Physicians and Surgeons, because they had developed a lot of the techniques for isolation of amino acids and such. So I worked actually in three places, but the home base was really Harold Urey's laboratory. Well, Harold Urey was a very perceptive guy. I walked in and explained the project, which of course was completely foreign to him, although he'd read my proposal. But he'd never dealt with nitrogen fixation. So I went in and talked to him, explained the program, and he said, I'll tell you the first experiment you have to run. He said, what you have to do is find out whether this is a valid tracer by showing that there isn't any exchange reaction, that the reaction doesn't back up. If the reaction backs up, you could fix nitrogen and then release it again, and it would confuse the picture. So you have to know whether there's an exchange reaction. And here's the way you do it. You take some enriched, N15 enriched nitrogen gas, which is at equilibrium, and you mix it with some nitrogen from air, which also is at equilibrium, and you'll get a non-equilibrium distribution between the molecular species, a mass 28, 29, and 30. And if you dissociate the NN bond, it will approach equilibrium, which is statistically determined. There's at a particular concentration, if you dissociate the bond and reassociate it, there is a statistical probability that we reassociate in a specific way. So if you get a change toward equilibrium, it means there's a reversal of the reaction. And he said, there's a laboratory, I get going on it, and ask the fellows if any help in generating the nitrogen and such. So I went out, and one of the fellows named Miller and I set up the experiment, and we generated N15 enriched N2. As I said, Urey's the only person who had this available. Mm-hmm. Rittenberg and Schoenheimer got it from him, and anybody else had gotten it from him. So we set up the experiment with a non-equilibrium distribution of nitrogen over nitrogen-fixing azotobacter and tested, and there was no exchange. And so that was the first experiment. And Urey was sort of tickled by this, and he came back, he had gone down to a meeting of some physical meeting, chemist meeting or something, and he'd run into Hugh Taylor, who was from Princeton, a rather distinguished physical chemist. And Hugh Taylor had gotten Urey aside, and he said, you know, Harold, he said, I may need some N15. He said, I have a student who's going to study the exchange reaction in nitrogen fixation this year. Urey said, forget it. He says, there is that exchange reaction. So he came back and reported this to him, and he was quite tickled that he'd been able to tell Hugh Taylor that he was barking up the wrong wrong tree. The reaction didn't exist.
Put in a whole year of work.
So the fellow that was going to do it had taken his degree in chemistry at Wisconsin. Hmm. So he had to find another project for the year. So then we went on to use N15 as a tracer, and there'd been a statement in the literature by Marty Kamen, who Marty is a quite a distinguished biochemist who had discovered carbon-14, which has revolutionized biochemistry, of course. So that's the radioactive carbon tracer that everybody uses in biochemistry. So Marty Kamen had discovered this, and he had also in the cyclotron, he was working at Berkeley in the cyclotron, and he'd also made some N13, this short half-life, 10.5 minute isotope, and he'd stuck it over some barley, and then he'd taken it out and he'd measured and there was radioactivity, so he'd reported nitrogen fixation in barley, and barley doesn't fix nitrogen according to all the records, except for a guy named Lippmann, who had reported that wheat and barley fixed nitrogen back about 1925. And Lippmann was the dean of the grad school at Berkeley at that time. So Marty took it over to show Lippmann that here he is exonerated. Lippmann thought that was terrific. Mm. And he did some quick calculations. It looked like about the same amount of fixation he'd reported. So he urged Marty to get in the literature right away and exonerate the dean who'd been attacked for his studies by many people. Mm. So Marty had published this, and And so one of the first things I tried was to see if there was any fixation by barley. And he had exposed the stuff for 20 minutes. So I exposed it under a stable isotope for 54 days, then analyzed, and there was absolutely no fixation. So the next time Marty came and found a nitrogen fixer, he came up and checked it in our laboratory here. And he had a real one that time, but he was pretty cautious the second time through and used N15. So that was sort of interesting. They checked that, and then I spent much of the spring after exposing a growing nitrogen-fixing culture of Azotobacter to N15-enriched N2, and then I fractionated it to find where the nitrogen had gone in the various nitrogenous compounds to get some hint as to the mechanism of the process. So this I did up in Schoenheimer's laboratory, and it turned out that the highest N15 concentration was glutamic acid, which was suggestive that ammonia was the key intermediate which was assimilated into organic compounds and then into the other amino acids. This made sense, and so this is what we did. Well, we came back here and we had to have a mass spectrometer for the analysis of the stable isotope. And so Professor Wallen over in physics and one of his students, a student named Epling, were good enough to go down in the shop and produce a mass spectrometer from scratch. They built the whole thing in the physics laboratory. The mass specs in that day were a little bit primitive. They were operated off batteries and such, and so we spent lots of hours over in physics keeping that instrument in operation because it was crucial to our use of nitrogen 15 as a tracer. So they built, built another one subsequently. Another mass spec. So physics turned out two mass spectrometers for us, and I used to spend a lot of time over in physics. So when biophysics was organized here, some people had the idea I was a biophysicist because I never seen around physics, which wasn't quite true. But anyway, we worked with N15 and collaborated with the physicists in terms of instrumentation. And then it was sort of this was a technique that opened up all kinds of possibilities, and by application of it over a period of years, we obtained several lines of evidence which established that the key compound in nitrogen fixation that's assimilated is, in fact, ammonia. And so there were a number of lines of evidence that we used.
So that was one of your major achievements.
Yeah, so there had been an active controversy between Perry Wilson and A.I. Virtanen, who was a Nobel laureate from Helsinki, mm-hmm. Finland. Finland's only Nobel laureate. Mm-hmm. And Perry had worked over in Virtanen's laboratory in 36, I guess it was, and I worked on Virtanen's lab in 54. So we kept in touch with Virtanen, but he maintained that hydroxylamine was a key compound, and our data had always suggested ammonia, and the N15 as a tracer established very clearly that ammonia is the key compound in the nitrogen fixation chain. So
this is the second session of the interview with Robert Burris. The date is June 3rd, 1983.
Talking then about the use of N15 as a tracer and the work subsequent to the year at Columbia, which we picked up the technique in Urey's laboratory. Excuse me.
Okay.
The N15, as one might anticipate, served as a very useful tracer, and we ran a variety of types of experiments to establish that ammonia was a key, so-called key intermediate in nitrogen fixation. The key intermediate had been defined as a nitrogenous compound that combined with organic compounds to form a fixed organic nitrogen compound.
Excuse me.
As indicated, the years immediately after coming back from Columbia, we were spent in bacteriology, and then in 44 we moved down to the biochemistry department and replaced Dr. Tottingham, who had died suddenly in the spring of 1944. I took over his course in plant biochemistry at that time, and I have taught it since, up through 1982. It obviously has changed drastically over those years, as there's been a tremendous expansion of knowledge in the areas of plant biochemistry, not only in nitrogen fixation, but in photosynthesis and many other aspects. We discussed something also about the laboratory course and how it evolved into an isotopes course, which Bill Huxter and I taught for some years. Now, the biochemistry department was a very active group and had rather a distinguished history from the time that Babcock arrived, and through the era from 1906 to 1946 when E.B. Hart was the chairman of the department. Obviously, Hart, in his long period here, built the reputation of the department. It was based on a number of excellent staff members, such as McCollum, Steenbach, Elvium, Link, Peterson, Johnson, Phillips, and others who had consistently contributed to the research image of the department. There were some colorful incidents along the way. These people were all, in a sense, inbred in the department, or virtually all of them. Of course, Hart had come from New York State, but had been here for a long time. Elvium had grown up virtually in the shadow of the university and had stayed on through his entire academic career. Peterson had come, I think, about 1910 with the assignment to teach the home economics students biochemistry, and he'd stayed on to work in the area of fermentation and had collaborated extensively with E.B. Fred and others in the bacteriology department. K.P. Link was also a product of the department. He had worked with Tottingham as a student, and then had gone to Europe on a National Research Council fellowship, where he got into a substantial amount of trouble during the course of the year and did work at about three different laboratories, I believe. He always had a soft spot in his heart for St. Andrews, where he spent a portion of his time. He also spent a good deal of time in Germany, and he was fascinated by microchemical methodology, which had been worked out there by Pregel. So when he came back, he brought a lot of equipment for microchemistry and introduced it on the campus.
Was this the first campus in the States to have such a lab? That's what Harold Campbell said.
Well, I'm not sure whether it was the first or not, but it was really a relatively new technique, and had been developed in great detail by Pregel in Germany. And Link brought along microbalances, which were substantially more sensitive than the usual analytical balances that were in the laboratories. And he brought along the specific combustion chains and some of the specialized glassware and such. He set up a laboratory around this, and he had Scheffel, a German fellow who served as a microchemist. So this was important in many of their organic syntheses and such, as an aid in characterizing the compound to have a good carbohydrate nitrogen analysis. And Link's laboratory really became a sort of a model laboratory. It was a beautiful laboratory and very well maintained. It was sort of the show spot in biochemistry, really, was KP's laboratory. And it was well run. It attracted good students, and he had a very productive program going there. Now, KP always had a tendency to get in trouble about a variety of things. He'd grown up, of course, down in Indiana. His father was a minister, and he tended to be a bit of a maverick about certain things, and he would espouse causes that were relatively unpopular. Mm-hmm. one was not always convinced that he was that dedicated to the cause, but if it were an unpopular cause, he was rather ready to embrace it. In any case, he always put on a good show on these things, and one must always, however, credit him with some very good chemistry that he did. He had some good developments in his laboratory. He trained people well, and he trained some very good biochemists. And so although he was sometimes a thorn in the side of the administration, he was a very productive scientist, and he was an excellent lecturer. He would go out of his way to cause trouble to the administration. The administrators are not his special friends, with the exception of E.B. Hart, who was the chairman of biochem. And when K.P. got into trouble, you could depend on E.B. Hart to bail him out.
Oh, I guess I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, E.B. was, I guess he sort of thought of K.P. as one of his protégés. And so if one goes into the old correspondence in the department, you can find some very strong letters between the administration and K.P. with E.B. Hart siding with K.P. and trying to smooth the waters once more.
This is when Fred becomes president, is that right?
Oh, long before that. Oh, long before that.
Because Frank and Link were friends.
Frank Strong.
No, Glenn Frank.
Oh, Glenn Frank.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know. But the correspondence goes way back to the 1920s. He was in trouble for a long time.
Yeah.
Later on, he was... I don't know what you'd say he was really in trouble, but later on he got a lot of publicity by being the sponsor of the Young Communist Club on campus and that sort of thing, which was sort of ready-made for KP to step in and, back it, because it was an unpopular cause by and large. If there was any controversy between the students and the staff, KP automatically took the point of the student.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a strong supporter, and I'm sure they appreciated this fact. No, he got into trouble when he was abroad in his postdoctoral year, and he needled people constantly thereafter.
Yeah.
And so it was just sort of a way of life for KP. But he continued to be a productive scientist and turn out some very well-trained students, and so one has to give him credit for that.
Well, would you talk about the whole dicumarol business?
Yeah, well, I was not really in on dicumarol at the time this was breaking. I was actually, I guess, probably up in bacteriology, so it was a step removed from biochemistry, but everybody heard the story, and the story, I'm sure, got better with the years about the fellow coming in with a bucket of blood and speaking in a thick German accent about his cows dying and such. And I never saw the bucket, and I don't know how many people ever saw the bucket of blood. But it got to the point where he came in a blizzard. I don't know whether he came in a blizzard or not, but the story got better and better with the years and all the accompanying details. One sometimes is a little suspicious about verbatim sentences which are recited 20 years after the event. Personally, I don't really usually remember him quite that vividly, but in any case, the story got to be pretty good about the fellow coming in with a bucket of blood from his dying cows. In any case, obviously the cows did die, and they died from hemorrhage, and the hemorrhage was caused by dicumarol, and the dicumarol was in the spoiled sweet clover hay.
Yeah, well, I was thinking more of and that's been written up, but
it's written up on infinitum.
Yes, I'm thinking more of the of Mark Stahmann's role in the patent. You said the other day that Link didn't pay any attention to patenting it until he realized it was going to be worth something. And
well, I mean, the story on the patents, I'm not entirely clear, but I'm sure it's all in the Wharf record, so one can check it there for a. Accurate statement.
I've seen the correspondence of Stahmann's with Link about the patent, but
the case was very clear that there were a number of people involved, as there aren't anything like this in the laboratory. They were involved in the isolation of the dicumarol, the characterization of the compound, and then the demonstration of the physiological activity. Yeah. And so there were a lot of people involved, but there was no effort to patent this on Leake's part, and Mark Stahmann thought that it had possibilities and should be patented. So without any encouragement from KP, Mark took it upon himself to get the patent on it. Mm-hmm. And this patent was issued very shortly before it would have been outlawed. You see, if a thing is published, and then if nothing is done about it for a year, then it becomes public property. Mm-hmm. And so Mark took it upon himself before this occurred to get a patent on it. And if it hadn't been for that, there would have been no patent on the dicumarol, and I think I'm not quite sure about the warfarin, just how that comes into the picture, but certainly the basic patent was issued because of Mark Stahmann's initiative, not from KP or anyone else. And it was issued in the name of three people, or this is my understanding, at least three people are credited by Wharf to share the income. Mm-hmm. This is Mark Stahmann, K.P. Link, and Miyoshi Okawa. And so the record very clearly shows that those three people are to share any income from this patent. Now, the patent, the pattern in Wharf, of course, was set by Harry Steenbach on the vitamin D. When he wanted to give the entire proceeds to Wharf, and they insisted that somebody subsequently might need the money, and they insisted that he take 15%. And so 15% has been the patent, and that 15 was split three ways, 5-5 and 5% to Stahmann, Link, and Miyoshi Okawa. And of course, with the publicity that's come in subsequent years, nobody associates Mark and Miyoshi Okawa with this. They all think of KP because he was a great friend of the newspapers and was always willing to release something to the newspapers, and so he became the friend of the reporters, and they always went to him for the story. And the story always was that it was that appeared in the newspaper, but it was KP, and the rest of them never got any recognition. But when any question was raised, it went back to the legal record with Wharf, and there's no question that the three people share.
There's something about Huebner in there. Wasn't he in on it?
Well, Charlie Huebner was around that time, and as I say, undoubtedly there were a lot of other people in on it. And one way, KP, of course, by the time this was issued, had a falling out with Mark, and so he was not particularly gracious about sharing the proceeds three ways with Mark, particularly with Mark. I don't think he cared a bit about whether Miyoshi got any, but he didn't want to see Mark getting 5%. So he made a magnanimous gesture at a public meeting here in the Biochem building, in which he listed about 20 people on a long sheet of brown wrapping paper and hung it up in the Biochem auditorium, listing every dishwasher and every lab assistant who'd been in the laboratory at the time of the development, said he wanted to share it with all 20 of these people. He didn't want to run any poor person out of his credit like Steenbach had done with Harvey or with Black. There was a fellow named Black who was in on the Steenbach thing as a student around at that time. And so KP was always trying to dig Steenbach to take it. Harry, actually, Steenbach was very generous. He wanted to give the whole thing to the Wharf, but KP always liked it. Dig him. So he was going to be magnanimous. Of course, the magnanimous gesture would cut Mark down to less than 1%. And was willing to take less than 1% himself, if thereby he could cut Mark down to less than 1%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was the nature of the magnanimous gesture. It was a big gesture, but it was an absolute fraud.
So what sort of a person was Mark Stahmann?
Well, Mark was a very mild guy compared to KP, and he's a very confident laboratory man, and he'd had a lot of experience. Of course, he'd taken his degree with KP, and he'd gone to Rockefeller, and he'd had a successful career.
Was he one of the best of the graduate students around?
Well, you know, there were a lot of them. I'd say were the Charlie Huebner and people like that. They were pretty much a lot of the same cut, I'd say, and so there were a number of them that I wouldn't put Mark particularly above the rest of them. I think Stan Moore was the one who stood out. I mean, he had, had the most distinguished career subsequently. And Clint Ballew, who's been on the staff at Berkeley for many years, Clint has had a very distinguished career out of KP's lab. You know, I would say Mark was the general cut of the students there in Link's laboratory. But he was a very competent guy. Mark was a Mormon. He came here from Utah. He had a strong Mormon background. He's married to a Mormon. And he was rather, rather religious in his approach to things. You know, he was not anybody who raised any fight about issues. You know, he was a relatively mild
person. So he doesn't stand
person.
Out as a colorful personality in the department.
No.
You haven't said much about Elfium.
I didn't say much about Connie?
I don't think you've said much
about
it
well,
yet. This
I mentioned earlier that I'd taken Connie's course in the general course in biochemistry, and I never really had much direct dealings with Connie until I came down here and before 1944 and interviewed him when I was being considered for a staff position.
Were you in? Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, this was before Tottingham's death.
Yeah.
I had actually interviewed, and my name had been suggested by Van Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you did,
and
you
Connie,
said that, yeah.
I said that, and Connie had interviewed me, so I'd had that chance to chat with him. But I hadn't really crossed his path very much. But then I came in 44, and Hart was chairman until 46, and then Connie was chairman from 46 to 58, so I served for 12 years under Connie Elwing as chairman. And Connie was an amazingly well-organized person. He ran the grand school in the afternoons, and he ran the biochem department in the mornings, and he continued to turn out the research work. And Connie didn't have the pick of the students either. Connie had some good students, but on the other hand, if there were rejects in the department, as chairman, he had to sort of pick them up. And
oh, really?
So he didn't really have, I don't think he had the cream of the students very frequently, and still he was very productive. And he kept on top of things. He knew what was going on in research. Every day he was up and looked at the animal colony and talked to the students. So, and he made decisions with great facility.